matters as well. One could be forgiven for pointing out that Richardson's conjecture that mankind was getting less warlike depended on segregating the world wars into a microclass of two, in which statistics are futile. His other analyses counted all wars alike, with World War II no different from, say, a 1952 revolution in Bolivia with 1,000 deaths. Richardson's son pointed out to him that if he divided his data into large and small wars, they seemed to show opposing trends. Small wars were becoming considerably less frequent, but larger wars, while fewer in number, were becoming somewhat more frequent. A different way of putting it is that between 1820 and 1953, wars became less frequent but more lethal. Richardson tested the pattern of contrast and found that it was statistically significant. The next section will show that this, too, was an astute conclusion. Other data sets confirm that until 1945, the story of war in Europe and among major nations in general was one of fewer but more damaging wars. So does that mean that mankind got more warlike or less? There is no single answer, because warlike can refer to two different things. It can refer to how likely nations are to go to war, or it can refer to how many people are killed when they do. Imagine two rural counties with the same size population. One of them has 100 teenage arsonists who delight in setting forest fires. But the forests are in isolated patches, so each fire dies out before doing much damage. The other county has just two arsonists, but its forests are connected, so that a small blaze is likely to spread, as they say, like wildfire. Which county has the worst forest fire problem? One could argue it either way. As far as the amount of reckless depravity is concerned, the first county is worse. As far as the risk of serious damage is concerned, the second is. Nor is it obvious which county will have the greater amount of overall damage, the one with a lot of little fires or the one with a few big ones. To make sense of these questions, we have to turn from the statistics of time to the statistics of magnitude. The Statistics of Deadly Quarrels, Part 2, The Magnitude of Wars. Richardson made a second major discovery about the statistics of deadly quarrels. It emerged when he counted the number of quarrels of each magnitude, how many with death tolls in the thousands, how many in the tens of thousands, how many in the hundreds of thousands, and so on. It isn't a complete surprise that there were lots of little wars and only a few big ones. What was a surprise was how neat the relationship turned out to be. When Richardson plotted the log of the number of quarrels of each magnitude against the log of the number of deaths per quarrel, that is, the magnitude itself, he ended up with a graph that looks like a perfect staircase. Scientists are accustomed to seeing data fall into perfect straight lines when they come from hard sciences like physics, such as the volume of gas plotted against its temperature. But not in their wildest dreams do they expect the messy data from history to be so well behaved. The data we are looking at come from a ragbag of deadly quarrels ranging from the greatest cataclysm in the history of humanity to a coup d'etat in a banana republic, and from the dawn of the Industrial Revolution to the dawn of the computer age. The jaw drops when seeing this mélange of data fall onto a perfect diagonal. Piles of data in which the log of the frequency of a certain kind of entity is proportional to the log of the size of that entity, so that a plot on log-log paper looks like a straight line, are called power law distributions. The name comes from the fact that when you put away the logarithms and go back to the original numbers, the probability of an entity showing up in the data is proportional to the size of that entity raised to some power, which translates visually to the slope of the line in the log-log plot, plus a constant. In this case, the power is minus 1.5, which means that with every tenfold jump in the death toll of a war, you can expect to find about a third as many of them. Richardson plotted murders, quarrels of magnitude zero, on the same graph as wars, noting that qualitatively they follow the overall pattern. They are much, much less damaging than the smallest wars, and much, much more frequent. But he was pushing his luck when he said that all deadly quarrels fell along a single continuum. Richardson gamely connected the murder point to the war line with a swoopy curve so that he could interpolate the numbers of quarrels with death tolls in the single digits, the tens, and the hundreds, which are missing from the historical record. These are the skirmishes beneath the military horizon that fall in the crack between criminology and history. But for now, let's ignore the murders and skirmishes and concentrate on the wars. Could Richardson just have been lucky with his sample? 50 years later, the political scientist Lars Erik Sederman plotted a newer set of numbers in a major data set of battle deaths from the Correlates of War project, comprising 97 interstate wars between 1820 and 1997. Scientists are intrigued by power law distributions for two reasons. One is that the distribution keeps turning up in measurements of things that you would think have nothing in common. One of the first power law distributions was discovered in the 1930s by the linguist G. K. Zipf when he plotted the frequency of words in the English language. If you count up the instances of each of the words in a large corpus of text, you'll find around a dozen that occur extremely frequently. That is, in more than 1% of all word tokens, including the, 7%, be, 4%, of, 4%, and, 3%, and a, 2%. Around 3,000 occur in the medium frequency range, centered on 1 in 10,000, such as confidence, junior, and afraid. Tens of thousands occur once every million words, including embitterer, memorialize, and titular. And hundreds of thousands have frequencies far less than 1 in a million, like kankadort, apotropaic, and deliques. Another example of a power law distribution was discovered in 1906 by the economist Vilfredo Pareto when he looked at the distribution of incomes in Italy. A handful of people were filthy rich, while a much larger number were dirt poor. Since these discoveries, power law distributions have also turned up, among other places, in the populations of cities, the commonness of names, the popularity of websites, the number of citations of scientific papers, the sales figures of books and musical recordings, the number of species in biological taxa, and the sizes of moon craters. The second remarkable thing about power law distributions is that they look the same over a vast range of values. To understand why this is so striking, let's compare power law distributions to a more familiar distribution called the normal Gaussian or Bell curve. With measurements like the heights of men or the speeds of cars on a freeway, most of the numbers pile up around an average, and they tail off in both directions, falling into a curve that looks like a bell. For example, there are lots of men around 5 feet 10 inches tall. Fewer who are 5 feet 6 inches or 6 feet 2 inches, not that many who are 5 feet or 6 feet 8 inches, and no one who is shorter than 1 foot 11 inches or taller than 8 feet 11 inches, the two extremes in the Guinness Book of World Records. The ratio of the tallest man in the world to the shortest man in the world is 4.8. And you can bet that you will never meet a man who is 20 feet tall. Which brings us back to wars. Since wars fall into a power law distribution, some of the mathematical properties of these distributions may help us understand the nature of wars and the mechanisms that give rise to them. For starters, power law distributions with the exponent we see for wars do not even have a finite mean. There is no such thing as a typical war. We should not expect, even on average, that a war will proceed until the casualties pile up to an expected level and then will naturally wind itself down. Also, power law distributions are scale-free. As you slide up or down the line in the log-log graph, it always looks the same, namely like a line. The mathematical implication is that as you magnify or shrink the units you are looking at, the distribution looks the same. Suppose that computer files of 2 kilobytes are a quarter as common as files of 1 kilobyte. And if we stand back and look at files in higher ranges, we find the same thing. Files of 2 megabytes are a quarter as common as files of 1 megabyte, and files of 2 terabytes are a quarter as common as files of 1 terabyte. In the case of wars, you can think of it this way. What are the odds of going from a small war, say, with 1,000 deaths, to a medium-sized war with 10,000 deaths? It's the same as the odds of going from a medium-sized war of 10,000 deaths to a large war of 100,000 deaths, or from a large war of 100,000 deaths to a historically large war of 1 million deaths, or from a historic war to a world war. Finally, power law distributions have thick tails, meaning that they have a non-negligible number of extreme values. You will never meet a 20-foot man or see a car driving down the freeway at 500 miles per hour. But you could conceivably come across a city of 14 million, or a book that was on the bestseller list for 10 years, or a moon crater big enough to see from the Earth with the naked eye, or a war that killed 55 million people. The thick tail of a power law distribution, which declines gradually rather than precipitously as you rocket up the magnitude scale, means that extreme values are extremely unlikely, but not astronomically unlikely. It's an important difference. The chances of meeting a 20-foot tall man are astronomically unlikely. You can bet your life it will never happen. But the chances that a city will grow to 20 million, or that a book will stay on the bestseller list for 20 years, is merely extremely unlikely. It probably won't happen, but you could well imagine it happening. I hardly need to point out the implications for war. It is extremely unlikely that the world will see a war that will kill 100 million people, and less likely still that it will have one that will kill a billion. But in an age of nuclear weapons, our terrified imaginations and the mathematics of power law distributions agree, it is not astronomically unlikely. So far, I've been discussing the causes of war as Platonic abstractions, as if armies were sent into war by equations. What we really need to understand is why wars distribute themselves as power laws. That is, what combination of psychology and politics and technology could generate this pattern? At present, we can't be sure of the answer. Too many kinds of mechanisms can give rise to power law distributions, and the data on wars are not precise enough to tell us which is at work. Still, the scale-free nature of the distribution of deadly quarrels gives us an insight about the drivers of war. Intuitively, it suggests that size doesn't matter. The same psychological or game-theoretic dynamics that govern whether quarreling coalitions will threaten, back down, bluff, engage, escalate, fight on, or surrender apply whether the coalitions are street gangs, militias, or armies of great powers. Presumably, this is because humans are social animals who aggregate into coalitions, which amalgamate into larger coalitions, and so on. Yet at any scale, these coalitions may be sent into battle by a single clique or individual, be it a gang leader, a capo, warlord, king, or emperor. How can the intuition that size doesn't matter be implemented in models of armed conflict that actually generate power law distributions? The simplest is to assume that the coalitions themselves are power law distributed in size, that they fight each other in proportion to their numbers, and that they suffer losses in proportion to their sizes. We know that some human aggregations, namely municipalities, are power law distributed, and we know the reason. One of the commonest generators of a power law distribution is preferential attachment. The bigger something is, the more new members it attracts. Preferential attachment is also known as accumulated advantage, the rich get richer, and the Matthew effect, after the passage in Matthew chapter 25, verse 29, that Billie Holiday summarized as, "Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose." Websites that are popular attract more visitors, making them even more popular. Best-selling books are put on the best-seller lists, which lure more people into buying them. and cities with lots of people offer more professional and cultural opportunities, so more people flock to them. How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? Richardson considered this simple explanation, but found that the numbers didn't add up. If deadly quarrels reflected city sizes, then for every tenfold reduction in the size of a quarrel, there should be 10 times as many of them. But in fact, there are fewer than 4 times as many. Also, in recent centuries, wars have been fought by states, not cities, and states follow a log-normal distribution, a warped bell curve, rather than a power law. Another kind of mechanism has been suggested by the science of complex systems, which looks for laws that govern structures that are organized into similar patterns despite being made of different stuff. Many complexity theorists are intrigued by systems that display a pattern called self-organized criticality. You can think of criticality as the straw that broke the camel's back. A small input causes a sudden large output. Self-organized criticality would be a camel whose back healed right back to the exact strength at which straws of various sizes could break it again. A good example is a trickle of sand falling onto a sand pile, which periodically causes landslides of different sizes. The landslides are distributed according to a power law. An avalanche of sand stops at a point where the slope is just shallow enough to be stable, but the new sand trickling onto it steepens the slope and sets off a new avalanche. Earthquakes and forest fires are other examples. A fire burns a forest, which allows trees to grow back at random, forming clusters that can grow into each other and fuel another fire. Several political scientists have developed computer simulations that model wars on an analogy to forest fires. In these models, countries conquer their neighbors and create larger countries in the same way that patches of trees grow into each other and create larger patches. Just as a cigarette tossed in a forest can set off either a brush fire or a conflagration, a destabilizing event in the simulation of states can set off either a skirmish or a world war. In these simulations, the destructiveness of a war depends mainly on the territorial size of the combatants and their alliances. But in the real world, variations in destructiveness also depend on the resolve of the two parties to keep a war going, with each hoping that the other will collapse first. Some of the bloodiest conflicts in modern history, such as the American Civil War, World War I, the Vietnam War, and the Iran-Iraq War, were wars of attrition, where both sides kept shoveling men and materiel into the maw of the war machine, hoping that the other side would exhaust itself first. John Maynard Smith, the biologist who first applied game theory to evolution, modeled this kind of standoff as a war of attrition game. Each of two contestants competes for a valuable resource by trying to outlast the other, steadily accumulating costs as he waits. In the original scenario, they might be heavily armored animals competing for a territory who stare at each other until one of them leaves. The costs are the time and energy the animals waste in the standoff, which they could otherwise use in catching food or pursuing mates. A game of attrition is mathematically equivalent to an auction, in which the highest bidder wins the prize and both sides have to pay the loser's low bid. And, of course, it can be analogized to a war in which the expenditure is reckoned in the lives of soldiers. The war of attrition is one of those paradoxical scenarios in game theory, like the prisoner's dilemma, the tragedy of the commons, and the dollar auction, in which a set of rational actors pursuing their interests end up worse off than if they had put their heads together and come to a collective and binding agreement. One might think that in an attrition game, each side should do what bidders on eBay are advised to do, decide how much the contested resource is worth, and bid only up to that limit. The problem is that this strategy can be gamed by another bidder. All he has to do is bid one more dollar, or wait just a bit longer, or commit another surge of soldiers, and he wins. He gets the prize for close to the amount you think it is worth, while you have to forfeit that amount too, without getting anything in return. You would be crazy to let that happen, so you are tempted to use the strategy, always outbid him by a dollar, which he is tempted to adopt as well. You can see where this leads. Thanks to the perverse logic of a nutrition game, in which the loser pays too, the bidders may keep bidding after the point at which the expenditure exceeds the value of the prize. They can no longer win, but each side hopes not to lose as much. The technical term for this outcome in game theory is a ruinous situation. It is also called a Pyrrhic victory. The military analogy is profound. One strategy that can evolve in a war of attrition game, where the expenditure, recall, is in time, is for each player to wait a random amount of time, with an average wait time that is equivalent in value to what the resource is worth to them. In the long run, each player gets good value for his expenditure, but because the waiting times are random, neither is able to predict the surrender time of the other and reliably outlast him. In other words, they follow the rule. At every instant, throw a pair of dice, and if they come up, say, 4, concede. If not, throw them again. This is, of course, like a Poisson process, and by now you know that it leads to an exponential distribution of wait times, since a longer and longer wait depends on a less and less probable run of tosses. Since the contest ends when the first side throws in the towel, the contest durations will also be exponentially distributed. Returning to our model, where the expenditures are in soldiers rather than seconds, if real wars of attrition were like the war of attrition modeled in game theory, and if all else were equal, then wars of attrition would fall into an exponential distribution of magnitudes. Of course, real wars fall into a power law distribution, which has a thicker tail than an exponential, in this case a greater number of severe wars. But an exponential can be transformed into a power law if the values are modulated by a second exponential process pushing in the opposite direction. And attraction games have a twist that might do just that. If one side in an attrition game were to leak its intention to concede in the next instant by, say, twitching or blanching or showing some other sign of nervousness, its opponent could capitalize on the tell by waiting just a bit longer, and it would win the prize every time. As Richard Dawkins has put it, in a species that often takes part in wars of attrition, one expects the evolution of a poker face. Now, one also might have guessed that organisms would capitalize on the opposite kind of signal, a sign of continuing resolve rather than impending surrender. If a contestant could adopt some defiant posture that means, "I'll stand my ground, I won't back down," that would make it rational for his opposite number to give up and cut its losses rather than escalate to mutual ruin. But there's a reason we call it posturing. Any coward can cross his arms and glower, but the other side can simply call his bluff. Only if a signal is costly, if the defiant party holds a hand over a candle or cuts his arm with a knife, can he show that he means business? Of course, paying a self-imposed cost would be worthwhile only if the prize is especially valuable to him, or if he had reason to believe that he could prevail over his opponent if the contest escalated. In the case of a war of attrition, one can imagine a leader who has a changing willingness to suffer a cost over time, increasing as the conflict proceeds and his resolve toughens. His motto would be, "We fight on so that our boys shall not have died in vain." This mindset, known as loss aversion, the sunk cost fallacy, and throwing good money after bad, is patently irrational. But it is surprisingly pervasive in human decision-making. People stay in an abusive marriage because of the years they have already put into it, or sit through a bad movie because they have already paid for the ticket, or try to reverse a gambling loss by doubling their next bet, or pour money into a boondoggle because they've already poured so much money into it. Though psychologists don't fully understand why people are suckers for sunk costs, a common explanation is that it signals a public commitment. The person is announcing, "When I make a decision, I'm not so weak, stupid, or indecisive that I can be easily talked out of it." In a contest of resolve like an attrition game, loss aversion could serve as a costly and hence credible signal that the contestant is not about to concede, preempting his opponent's strategy of outlasting him just one more round. I already mentioned some evidence from Richardson's dataset which suggests that combatants do fight longer when a war is more lethal. Small wars show a higher probability of coming to an end with each succeeding year than do large wars. The magnitude numbers in the Correlates of War dataset also show signs of escalating commitment. Wars that are longer in duration are not just costlier in fatalities, they are costlier than one would expect from their durations alone. If we pop back from the statistics of war to the conduct of actual wars, we can see the mechanism at work. Many of the bloodiest wars in history owe their destructiveness to leaders on one or both sides pursuing a blatantly irrational loss aversion strategy. Hitler fought the last months of World War II with a maniacal fury well past the point when defeat was all but certain, as did Japan. Lyndon Johnson's repeated escalations of the Vietnam War inspired a protest song that has served as a summary of people's understanding of that destructive war. We were waist deep in the Big Muddy. The big fool said to push on. The systems biologist Jean-Baptiste Michel has pointed out to me how escalating commitments in a war of attrition could produce a power law distribution. All we need to assume is that leaders keep escalating as a constant proportion of their past commitment. The size of each surge is, say, 10% of the number of soldiers that have fought so far. A constant proportional increase would be consistent with the well-known discovery in psychology called Weber's Law. For an increase in intensity to be noticeable, it must be a constant proportion of the existing intensity. If a room is illuminated by 10 light bulbs, you'll notice a brightening when an 11th is switched on. But if it is illuminated by 100 light bulbs, you won't notice the 101st. Someone would have to switch on another 10 bulbs before you notice the brightening. Richardson observed that people perceive lost lives in the same way. Contrast, for example, the many days of newspaper sympathy over the loss of the British submarine Thetis in time of peace with the terse announcement of similar losses during the war. This contrast may be regarded as an example of the Weber-Fechner doctrine that an increment is judged relative to the previous amount. The psychologist Paul Slovak has recently reviewed several experiments that support this observation. The quotation falsely attributed to Stalin, "One death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic," gets the numbers wrong, but captures a real fact about human psychology. If escalations are proportional to past commitments, and a constant proportion of soldiers sent to the battlefield are killed in battle, then losses will increase exponentially as a war drags on, like compound interest. And if wars are attrition games, their durations will also be distributed exponentially. Recall the mathematical law that a variable will fall into a power law distribution if it is an exponential function of a second variable that is distributed exponentially. My own guess is that the combination of escalation and attrition is the best explanation for the power law distribution of war magnitudes. Though we may not know exactly why wars fall into a power law distribution, the nature of that distribution, scale-free, thick-tailed, suggests that it involves a set of underlying processes in which size doesn't matter. Armed coalitions can always get a bit larger, wars can always last a bit longer, and losses can always get a bit heavier, with the same likelihood, regardless of how large, long, or heavy they were to start with. The next obvious question about the statistics of deadly quarrels is, what destroys more lives, the large number of small wars or the few big ones? A power law distribution itself doesn't give the answer. One can imagine a data set in which the aggregate damage from the wars of each size adds up to the same number of deaths. One war with 10 million deaths, 10 wars with a million deaths, 100 wars with 100,000 deaths, all the way down to 10 million murders with one death apiece. But in fact, distributions with exponents greater than one, which is what we get for wars, will have the numbers skewed toward the tail. A power law distribution with an exponent in this range is sometimes said to follow the 80-20 rule, also known as the Pareto principle, in which, say, the richest 20% of the population controls 80% of the wealth. The ratio may not be 80-20 exactly, but many power law distributions have this kind of lopsidedness. For example, the 20% most popular websites get around two-thirds of the hits. Richardson added up the total number of deaths from all deadly quarrels in each magnitude range. The computer scientist Brian Hayes has plotted them. The shape of the graph is striking. It has peaks at each end and a sag in the middle. That tells us that the most damaging kinds of lethal violence, at least from 1820 to 1952, were murders and world wars. All the other kinds of quarrels killed far fewer people. That has remained true in the 60 years since. In the United States, 37,000 military personnel died in the Korean War and 58,000 died in Vietnam. No other war came close. Yet an average of 17,000 people are murdered in the country every year, adding up to almost a million deaths since 1950. Likewise, in the world as a whole, homicides outnumber war-related deaths, even if one includes the indirect deaths from hunger and disease. Richardson also estimated the proportion of deaths that were caused by deadly quarrels of all magnitudes combined, from murders to world wars. The answer was 1.6%. He notes, "This is less than one might have guessed from the large amount of attention which quarrels attract. Those who enjoy wars can excuse their taste by saying that wars, after all, are much less deadly than disease. Again, this continues to be true by a large margin. That the two world wars killed 77% of the people who died in all the wars that took place in a 130-year period is an extraordinary discovery. Wars don't even follow the 80-20 rule that we are accustomed to seeing in power law distributions. They follow an 82 rule. Almost 80% of the deaths were caused by 2% of the wars. The lopsided ratio tells us that the global effort to prevent deaths in war should give the highest priority to preventing the largest wars. The ratio also underscores the difficulty of reconciling our desire for a coherent historical narrative with the statistics of deadly quarrels. In making sense of the 20th century, our desire for a good story arc is amplified by two statistical illusions. One is the tendency to see meaningful clusters in randomly spaced events. Another is the bell curve mindset that makes extreme values seem astronomically unlikely. So, when we come across an extreme event, we reason there must have been extraordinary design behind it. That mindset makes it difficult to accept that the worst two events in recent history, though unlikely, were not astronomically unlikely. Even if the odds had been increased by the tensions of the times, the wars did not have to start. And once they did, they had a constant chance of escalating to greater deadliness, no matter how deadly they already were. The two world wars were, in a sense, horrifically unlucky samples from a statistical distribution that stretches across a vast range of destruction. The trajectory of great power war. Richardson reached two broad conclusions about the statistics of war. Their timing is random, and their magnitudes are distributed according to a power law. But he was unable to say much about how the two key parameters, the probability of wars and the amount of damage they cause, change over time. His suggestion that wars were becoming less frequent but more lethal was restricted to the interval between 1820 and 1950, and limited by the spotty list of wars in his data set. How much more do we know about the long-term trajectory of war today? There is no good data set for all wars throughout the world since the start of recorded history, and we wouldn't know how to interpret it if there were. Societies have undergone such radical and uneven changes over the centuries that a single death toll for the entire world would sum over too many different kinds of societies. But the political scientist Jack Levy has assembled a data set that gives us a clear view of the trajectory of war in a particularly important slice of space and time. The time span is the era that began in the late 1400s when gunpowder, ocean navigation, and the printing press are said to have inaugurated the modern age, using one of the many definitions of the word modern. That is also the time at which sovereign states began to emerge from the medieval quilt of baronies and duchies. The countries that Levy focused on are the ones that belong to the great power system, the handful of states in a given epoch that can throw their weight around the world. Levy found that at any time a small number of 800-pound guerrillas are responsible for a majority of the mayhem. The great powers participated in about 70% of all the wars that Wright included in his half-millennium database for the entire world, and four of them have the dubious honor of having participated in at least a fifth of all European wars. This remains true today. France, the UK, the United States, and the USSR, Russia, have been involved in more international conflicts since World War II than any other countries. Countries that slip in or out of the Great Power League fight far more wars when they are in than when they are out. One more advantage of focusing on great powers is that with footprints that large, it's unlikely that any war they fought would have been missed by the scribblers of the day. As we might predict from the lopsided power law distribution of war magnitudes, the wars among great powers, especially the wars that embroiled several great powers at a time, account for a substantial proportion of all recorded war deaths. According to the African proverb, like most African proverbs attributed to many different tribes, when elephants fight, it is the grass that suffers. And these elephants have a habit of getting into fights with one another because they are not leashed by some larger suzerain, but constantly eye each other in a state of nervous Hobbesian anarchy. Levy set out technical criteria for being a great power and listed the countries that met them between 1495 and 1975. Most of them are large European states, France and England, Great Britain, UK, for the entire period, the entities ruled by the Habsburg dynasty through 1918, Spain until 1808, the Netherlands and Sweden in the 17th and early 18th centuries, Russia, USSR, from 1721 on, Prussia, Germany, from 1740 on, and Italy, from 1861 to 1943. But the system also includes a few powers outside Europe, the Ottoman Empire until 1699, the United States from 1898 on, Japan from 1905 to 1945, and China from 1949. Levy assembled a data set of wars that had at least 1,000 battle deaths a year, a conventional cutoff for a war in many data sets, such as the Correlates of War Project, that had a great power on at least one side, and that had a state on the other side. He excluded colonial wars and civil wars unless a great power was butting into a civil war on the side of the insurgency, which would mean that the war had pitted a great power against a foreign government. Using the Correlates of War data set, and in consultation with Levy, I have extended his data through the quarter century ending in 2000. Let's start with the Clash of the Titans, the wars with at least one great power on each side. Among them are what Levy called general wars, but which could also be called world wars, at least in the sense that World War I deserves that name. Not that the fighting spanned the globe, but that it embroiled most of the world's great powers. These include the 30 Years' War, 1618 through 48, six of the seven great powers, the Dutch War of Louis XIV, 1672 through 78, six of seven, the War of the League of Augsburg, 1688 through 97, five of seven, the War of the Spanish Succession, 1701 through 13, 5 of 6, the War of the Austrian Succession, 1739 through 48, Six of Six, The 7 Years' War, 1755 through 63, Six of Six, and the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, 1792 through 1815, Six of Six, together with the two world wars. There are more than 50 other wars in which two or more great powers faced off. One indication of the impact of war in different eras is the percentage of time that people had to endure wars between great powers, with their disruptions, sacrifices, and changes in priorities. Levy and Thompson plotted the percentage of years in each quarter century that saw the great powers of the day at war. In two of the early quarter centuries, 1550 through 75 and 1625 through 50, great powers fought each other in all 25 of the 25 years. These periods were saturated with the horrendous European wars of religion, including the First Huguenot War and the 30 Years' War. From there, the trend is unmistakably downward. Great powers fought each other for less of the time as the centuries proceeded, though with a few partial reversals, including the quarters with the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, and with the two world wars. The quarter century from 1950 to 1975 had one war between the great powers, the Korean War from 1950 to 1953, with the United States and China on opposite sides, and there has not been one since. Now let's zoom out and look at a wider view of war, the 100-plus wars with a great power on one side and any country whatsoever, great or not, on the other. With this larger data set, we can unpack the years at war measure from the previous study into two dimensions. The first is frequency. Once again, we see a decline over the five centuries. The great powers have become less and less likely to fall into wars. During the last quarter of the 20th, only four wars met Levy's criteria. The two wars between China and Vietnam, 1979 and 1987, the UN-sanctioned war to reverse Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, 1991, and NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia to halt its displacement of ethnic Albanians in Kosovo, 1999. The second dimension is duration. How long, on average, these wars dragged on. Once again, the trend is downward, though with a spike around the middle of the 17th century. This is not a simple-minded consequence of counting the 30 Years' War as lasting exactly 30 years. Following the practice of other historians, Levy divided it into four more circumscribed wars. Even after that slicing, the wars of religion in that era were brutally long. But from then on, the great powers sought to end their wars soon after beginning them, culminating in the last quarter of the 20th century when the four wars involving great powers lasted an average of 97 days. What about destructiveness? Levy measured the number of battle deaths in the wars fought by at least one great power. The loss of life rises from 1500 through the beginning of the 19th century, bounces downward in the rest of that century, resumes its climb through the two world wars, and then plunges precipitously during the second half of the 20th century. One gets an impression that over most of the half millennium, the wars that did take place were getting more destructive, presumably because of advances in military technology and organization. If so, the crossing trends, fewer wars but more destructive wars, would be consistent with Richardson's conjecture, though stretched out over a fivefold greater time span. We can't prove that this is what we're seeing, but Levy suggests that pure destructiveness can be separated out in a measure he calls concentration, namely the damage a conflict causes per nation per year of war. The late 20th century was unique in seeing declines both in the number of great power wars and in the killing power of each one, a pair of downslopes that captures the war aversion of the long peace. Before we turn from statistics to narratives in order to understand the events behind these trends, let's be sure they can be seen in a wider view of the trajectory of war. The trajectory of European war. Wars involving great powers offer a circumscribed but consequential theater in which we can look at historical trends in war. Another such theater is Europe. Not only is it the continent with the most extensive data on wartime fatalities, but it has had an outsized influence on the world as a whole. During the past half millennium, much of the world has been part of a European empire, and the remaining parts have fought wars with those empires. And trends in war and peace, no less than in other spheres of human activity, such as technology, fashion, and ideas, often originated in Europe and spilled out to the rest of the world. The extensive historical data from Europe also give us an opportunity to broaden our view of organized conflict from interstate wars involving the great powers to wars between less powerful nations, conflicts that miss the 1,000-death cutoff, civil wars, and genocides, together with deaths of civilians from famine and disease. What kind of picture do we get if we aggregate these other forms of violence, the tall spine of little conflicts, as well as the long tail of big ones? The political scientist Peter Breck is compiling the ultimate inventory of daily quarrels, which he calls the Conflict Catalog. His goal is to amalgamate every scrap of information on armed conflict in the entire corpus of recorded history since 1400. Breck began by merging the lists of wars assembled by Richardson, Wright, Sorokin, Eckhart, the Correlates of War Project, the historian Evan Luard, and the political scientist Kalevi Holsti. Most have a high threshold for including a conflict and legalistic criteria for what counts as a state. Breck loosened the criteria to include any recorded conflict that had as few as 32 fatalities in a year, and that involved any political unit that exercised effective sovereignty over a territory. He then went to the library and scoured the histories and atlases, including many published in other countries and languages. As we would expect from the power law distribution, loosening the criteria brought in not just a few cases at the margins, but a flood of them. Breck discovered at least 3 times as many conflicts as had been listed in all the previous datasets combined. The conflict catalog so far contains 4,560 conflicts that took place between 1400 CE and 2000 CE, 3,700 of which have been entered into a spreadsheet, and it will eventually contain 6,000. About a third of them have estimates of the number of fatalities, which Breck divides into military deaths, soldiers killed in battle, and total deaths, which includes the indirect deaths of civilians from war-caused starvation and disease. Breck kindly provided me with the dataset as it stood in 2010. Let's start by simply counting the conflicts, not just the wars embroiling great powers, but deadly quarrels great and small. These tallies offer an independent view of the history of war in Europe. Once again, we see a decline in one of the dimensions of armed conflict, how often they break out. When the story begins in 1400, European states were starting conflicts at a rate more than 3 a year. That rate has caromed downward to virtually none in Western Europe and to less than 1 conflict per year in Eastern Europe. Even that bounce is a bit misleading, because half of the conflicts were in countries that are coded in the dataset as Europe only because they were once part of the Ottoman or Soviet Empire. Today, they are usually classified as Middle Eastern or Central and South Asian. For example, conflicts in Turkey, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Dagestan, and Armenia. The other Eastern European conflicts were in former republics of Yugoslavia or the Soviet Union. These regions, Yugoslavia, Russia, USSR, and Turkey, were also responsible for the spike of European conflicts in the first quarter of the 20th century. What about the human toll of the conflicts? Here is where the capaciousness of the conflict catalog comes in handy. The power law distribution tells us that the biggest of the great power wars should account for the lion's share of the deaths from all wars, at least from all wars that exceed the 1,000-death cutoff, which make up the data I have plotted so far. But Richardson alerted us to the possibility that a large number of smaller conflicts, missed by traditional histories and datasets, could, in theory, pile up into a substantial number of additional deaths. The conflict catalog is the first long-term dataset that reaches down into that gray area and tries to list the skirmishes, riots, and massacres that fall beneath the traditional military horizon, though of course many more in the earlier centuries may never have been recorded. Unfortunately, the catalog is a work in progress, and at present fewer than half the conflicts have fatality figures attached to them. Until it is completed, we can get a crude glimpse of the trajectory of conflict deaths in Europe by filling in the missing values using the median of the death tolls from that quarter century. Brian Atwood and I have interpolated these values, adding up the direct and indirect deaths from conflicts of all types and sizes, divided them by the population of Europe in each period, and plotted them on a linear scale that shows Europe's ability to kill people outpaced its ability to breed more of them. But what really pops out are three hemoclisms. Other than the quarter century containing World War II, the most deadly time to have been alive in Europe was during the Wars of Religion in the early 17th century, followed by the quarter with World War I, then the period of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. The career of organized violence in Europe, then, looks something like this. There was a low but steady baseline of conflicts from 1400 to 1600, followed by the bloodbath of the Wars of Religion, a bumpy decline through 1775, followed by the French Troubles, a noticeable lull in the middle and late 19th century, and then, after the 20th century hemoclism, the unprecedented ground-hugging levels of the Long Peace. How can we make sense of the various slow drifts and sudden lurches in violence during the past half millennium among the great powers and in Europe? We have reached the point at which statistics must hand the baton over to narrative history. In the next sections, I'll tell the story behind the graphs by combining the numbers from the conflict counters with the narratives from historians and political scientists such as David Bell, Niall Ferguson, Azar Gatt, Michael Howard, John Keegan, Evan Luard, John Mueller, James Payne, and James Sheehan. Here is a preview. Think of the variations in rates of death as a composite of four currents. Modern Europe began in a Hobbesian state of frequent but small wars. The wars became fewer in number as political units became consolidated into larger states. At the same time, the wars that did occur were becoming more lethal, because of a military revolution that created larger and more effective armies. Finally, in different periods, European countries veered between totalizing ideologies that subordinated individual people's interests to a utopian vision and an Enlightenment humanism that elevated those interests as the ultimate value. The Hobbesian background and the ages of dynasties and religions. The backdrop of European history during most of the past millennium is ever-present warring. Carried over from the knightly raiding and feuding in medieval times, the wars embroiled every kind of political unit that emerged in the ensuing centuries. The sheer number of European wars is mind-boggling. Breck has compiled a prequel to the conflict catalog, which lists 1,148 conflicts from 900 CE to 1400 CE. And the catalog itself lists another 1,166 from 1400 CE to the present, about two new conflicts a year for 1,100 years. The vast majority of these conflicts, including most of the major wars involving great powers, are outside the consciousness of all but the most assiduous historians. To take some random examples, the Dano-Swedish War, 1516 through 25, the Schmalkaldic War, 1546 through 47, the Franco-Savoyan War, 1600 through 1601, the Turkish-Polish War, 1673 through 76, the War of Jülich Succession, 1609 through 10, and the Austria-Sardinia War, 1848 through 49, elicit blank stares from most educated people. Warring was not just prevalent in practice, but accepted in theory. Howard notes that among the ruling classes, peace was regarded as a brief interval between wars, and war was an almost automatic activity, part of the natural order of things. Luard adds that while many battles in the 15th and 16th centuries had moderately low casualty rates, even when casualties were high, there is little evidence that they weighed heavily with rulers or military commanders. They were seen, for the most part, as the inevitable price of war, which in itself was honorable and glorious. What were they fighting over? The motives were the three principal causes of quarrel identified by Hobbes: predation, primarily of land, preemption of predation by others, and credible deterrence or honor. The principal difference between European wars and the raiding and feuding of tribes, knights, and warlords was that the wars were carried out by organized political units rather than by individuals or clans. Conquest and plunder were the principal means of upward mobility in the centuries when wealth resided in land and resources rather than in commerce and innovation. Nowadays, ruling a dominion doesn't strike most of us as an appealing career choice, but the expression "to live like a king" reminds us that centuries ago it was the main route to amenities like plentiful food, comfortable shelter, pretty objects, entertainment on demand, and children who survived their first year of life. The perennial nuisance of royal bastards also reminds us that a lively sex life was a perquisite of European kings, no less than of harem-holding sultans, with serving maids a euphemism for concubines. But what the leaders sought was not just material rewards, but a spiritual need for dominance, glory, and grandeur. The bliss of contemplating a map and seeing more square inches tinted in the color that represents your dominion than someone else's. Luard notes that even when rulers had little genuine authority over their titular realms, they went to war for the theoretical right of overlordship, who owed allegiance to them, and for which territories. Many of the wars were pissing contests. Nothing was at stake but the willingness of one leader to pay homage to another in the form of titles, courtesies, and seating arrangements. Wars could be triggered by symbolic affronts such as a refusal to dip a flag, to salute colors, to remove heraldic symbols from a coat of arms, or to follow protocols of ambassadorial precedence. Though the motive to lead a dominant political bloc was constant through European history, the definition of the blocs changed, and with it the nature and extent of the fighting. In War in International Society, the most systematic attempt to combine a data set of war with narrative history, Luard proposes that the sweep of armed conflict in Europe may be divided into five ages, each defined by the nature of the blocs that fought for dominance. In fact, Luard's ages are more like overlapping strands in a rope than boxcars on a track, but if we keep that in mind, his scheme helps to organize the major historical shifts in war. Luard calls the first of his ages, which ran from 1400 to 1559, the Age of Dynasties. In this epoch, royal houses or extended coalitions based on kinship vied for control of European turfs. A little biology shows why the idea of basing leadership on inheritance is a recipe for endless wars of succession. Rulers always faced the dilemma of how to reconcile their thirst for everlasting power with an awareness of their own mortality. A natural solution is to designate an offspring, usually a firstborn son, as a successor. Not only do people think of their genetic progeny as an extension of themselves, but filial affection ought to inhibit any inclination of the successor to hurry things along with a little regicide. This would solve the succession problem in a species in which an organism could bud off as an adult clone of himself shortly before he died. But many aspects of the biology of Homo sapiens confound the scheme. First, humans are altricial, with immature newborns and a long childhood. That means that a father can die while his son is too young to rule. Second, character traits are polygenic and hence obey the statistical law called regression to the mean. However exceptional in courage or wisdom a parent may be, on average his or her children will be less so. As the critic Rebecca West wrote, 645 years of the Habsburg dynasty produced no genius, only two rulers of ability, countless dullards, and not a few imbeciles and lunatics. Third, humans reproduce sexually, which means that every person is the genetic legacy of two lineages, not one, each of which can lay a claim to the person's loyalties when he is alive and to his perquisites when he dies. Fourth, humans are sexually dimorphic, and though the female of the species may, on average, get less emotional gratification from conquest and tyranny,